and welcome to a special Behind Big Brother audio presentation. My name is Dave. The seventh season of Big Brother is drawing to a close. Over the past 7 years, Big Brother has seen much evolution and change. Before Big Brother was the glitzy game show it is today, it was a simple show about ordinary people going on an extraordinary adventure together, seeing no one but being seen by all. Many fans still claim that the early years of the show were the best ever produced, and many attribute that success to Peter Abbott, the executive producer. Recently, Tiggs and I caught up with Peter to chat about the early days of the show and about what life is like when you are Big Brother. We present this interview for you now, and we hope that you enjoy it. Thanks very much for joining us, Peter.
Hi, guys.
If we could, we'd like to launch straight into it and bring you right back to the beginning. Can you tell us a bit about the process of bringing Big Brother to Australia and where along this process you became involved?
Well, in one sense, Big Brother Everywhere is a deal. And then the side effect of the deal is a television show. And I think there were a lot of work put into getting the deal with Enda Mulvey, Southern Star at that stage, and then convincing a network here that it was a show worth running. And it's worth everybody understanding that the year before it had been pitched around and nobody bought it, and it took a lot of convincing to get someone to put up the money that's necessary to take a risk on a show like that. And while everybody was always confident, once it worked, everybody was extremely confident and always had been, but for a time there were a lot of very nervous people because it's a lot of money and no one ever knows how it's going to work.
Mm-hmm. Yes, understand.
And then, so about the time that the deal was done with 10, I was then asked whether I'd like to do it. And to be honest, I had to think about it for a couple of days and I responded that I'd be mad not to, but they had to think about whether or not the sort of show I would make was the sort of show they wanted, because I had a sense I wasn't going to make the same sort of show that was going to be that had been made in Europe, particularly. And at that point, no one had made it in America.
How strict were they about sticking to the original format? Like, how creative could you get with your own ideas?
They say that is Endemol say it's a local show everywhere it's made. In as much as they licensed it, I think we were the 14th or 15th country to do it. And everywhere had some subtle variations, but there are certain things that are absolutely fixed. At that point, the rule structure was absolutely fixed. There was a tonal thing that they were very fierce about, which is that it must be back to basics. And I remember some really humorous debates as we got down close to the final date. You know, that chair is too luxurious. We shouldn't have coat hangers in the room for them. They shouldn't be allowed to hang their clothes up. That's not back to basics. It's funny now, but it was all very fraught at the time. It seemed terribly important as far as the format police were concerned. Hilariously, of course, they left on the day that we started actually making the show. Good luck. I hope you have fun.
How did you end up deciding on filming TV, producing TV, in the middle of a theme park in Queensland?
That, again, was a deal-related thing. And I think actually a really clever idea. They there was a cross... Well, chairman of Southern Star had a relationship with Dreamworld. He was on their board, I believe. And so the thinking was that it provided an opportunity to make a bigger event out of it. And in particular, I think it informed the way we did the eviction shows. The fact that we had a big auditorium, we had the capacity to have 12 or 1,500 people come to the eviction shows, mm-hmm. gave it a distinctly different feel. In terms of making it, we, of course, were all part of a theme park attraction, which was a bit odd because we were being watched while we watched people. Really unnerving being in an editing room and having kids outside the window waving at you while you're trying to make some decision 10 seconds before you have to play it out to Sydney.
Was anyone nervous about doing it in Queensland? Because it's never seen national television production before or since, to my knowledge.
I was nervous about crewing it. There aren't a lot of, you know, as you say, there's not a lot of TV production up there. There was a lot of film production. You know, the Warner Brothers studios on the Gold Coast are put through a lot of drama. And also, you know, in terms of people like cameramen and, to a certain extent, editors, there's enough up there. Where we found it difficult was finding producers and directors, and actually by second series had resigned ourselves to more significant importation from Sydney and some people from Melbourne, actually, because there just aren't the numbers of people up there who've done anything of that scale and at that speed. It's not an intrinsically complicated show, but it is incredibly fast. If you think about the making of The Daily Show, you've got to make, every decision you make has got to be pretty much the decision, because you start at 4 in the morning and it's on air at 7 o'clock that night.
Yeah.
And you haven't got time to be teaching people or reviewing stuff much and saying, oh, no, I could do it another way. It's pretty much got to work. And for that, you need experience. It's so that people's immediate instincts are correct. I promise you there was some very interesting moments in Series 1. do you want to hear a couple?
Yeah, definitely.
They were pretty hairy. I mean, I think there was a Saturday night show that we put out that was supposed to be delivered at midday, I think. We were still cutting segments 6 and 7 when segment 1 was on air, and we were transmitting it through New Zealand. The poor guys, we'd lost our satellite connection, and so the fantastic Ray Martin, who's the technical director, I used to just go and look at him and steely look and say, Ray, I need you to find me another way of getting the show out of here. And he'd say, yes, and leave. didn't want to go in the debate. What time do you need me to get it out? As late as possible, please, Ray. And that was the entire conversation. And then we did the same thing with an uncut show. I remember we had an uncut show that was on air and we were still cutting the last segment and feeding it out. We often did that with Daily Shows. In fact, for the whole first week, we couldn't get the Daily Show to play out of the editing suites, and the editing suites kept crashing at the time of playout. And then I remember on the Friday of the first week, I was literally sitting in a fetal position in the cutting room, saying to somebody, will somebody get this on a motorbike and drive it up to Brisbane, because we finished our work but we just can't get it out of the machine and down to the network. And all that kind of pressure. It's kind of funny in hindsight, but at the time it was...
That sounds bloody scary.
Pretty intense.
Congratulations on doing the job you did under those conditions.
As I say, it's funny in hindsight.
You spoke earlier about how the European version, they were a bit worried that you wouldn't follow that version here. Did you actually watch any overseas versions before you started thinking about Big Brother Australia?
Oh, yeah, well, you watch bits of them. I mean, it's almost impossible to watch any of them meaningfully. For a start, they're in language which...
Yeah, of course.
You know, I've got a smattering of German and I can stumble through it. But the point is, you've actually got to understand it at quite a subtle level to know what's making it entertaining and what's making it compelling as drama. But they have rather a different ethos. They tend to make... they're more light entertainment / games shows out of it. There's a lot more stunts in the European shows, or certainly there was in the days I was making it. There were a lot more, you know, oh my goodness, visiting celebrities just arrived and is going to play a guitar.
okay.
Which is why I describe them as light entertainment shows. There's a lot more dressing up, and the tasks played a more important role, I think. We took the view that we were making effectively a real-life soap opera, particularly as we were against Home and Away, and that was an early evening time slot. We had to make a very different show to, say, the late-night versions that are generally run in Europe. It's generally a much later of the night thing, which is, explains why they cast their shows differently. They tend to make more outrageous people and get slightly more outrageous behaviour in the house. We were making a show that had to run at 7 o'clock. And so in all of that, I thought the tasks essentially were failing if you paid any particular attention to them. Though the tasks are there in our terms to create drama, in other words, to cause the housemates to have to interact in ways they're uncomfortable with or have to interact in ways that create new relationships. And it's those relationships and those tensions that we focused on rather than the specific, you know, who's ahead in the game, who's ahead in the task. We took a more dramatic view of it rather than a game view of it. Apart from that, the only other thing that I think was quite significant in the time slot and that thinking was the way the house was designed. If you look at the European ones, they tend to be quite claustrophobic. They tend to be reflective of European housing standards, I suppose, or styles. And being an Australian show for 7 o'clock, we wanted it to feel a little more like a basic but realistically Australian house, which is why we went for the colour schemes we did, and Michael Bridges, who designed it all, had a very strong view about all of that.
It was very Aussie in the early days. They had the deck and the barbecue and the Hills hoist and the chicken coop and...
Yeah. the famous chickens.
The famous chickens, yeah. They disappeared after a couple of years.
Yeah, well, I believe you had Peter Timms on the other day.
Yes, we interviewed him this afternoon.
Did you ask him about the chicken kicking?
I did, actually.
Okay. And which, yeah, I don't think he actually kicked it.
No.
He kicked at it.
Yes. He said that was the first time, because the housemates actually got to watch it back, that was the first time they saw what they looked like on TV. And they were more amazed at that than anything to do with the chickens or anything from that side of it.
Yeah. Actually, I'd forgotten that was the first time they'd seen them. They were the best looked after chickens in Australia, I think. but there's a lot of politics around animals for entertainment, and you know, undoubtedly he shouldn't have kicked at it, but I did think it sort of escalated into a slightly disproportionate fuss when in fact nothing had actually happened to the chicken.
If we could move on to the audition process, in the early years when you were in charge, the first part of the audition was a videotape. Nowadays it's a live walk-in at showgrounds or something or other. At what stage would you personally meet the potential housemates?
I watched all the tapes that were considered worth watching, which something like 1,500 or 2,000 tapes. Mm-hmm. I used to just lock myself in a room and start watching.
Was that a fun job?
Yeah,
for the first six, maybe?
For the first couple of days, it's pretty good. But it's a show that hangs on casting, you know, and I could never see how you could delegate the most important task in the show to anybody else. And in that sense, it was quite important to me, anyway, to the way I did it. I know there are other views about this, but I tried to see something in those tapes. It didn't matter really what the tape was. I just try and see something about a person. And so if you could just spot something, and I'd write notes about, think he's mischievous, think this. There's certain assumptions about the person on their forms, because as you're watching the tape, you're reading their form and you're kind of looking at the form and seeing if there's something interesting that they've actually written or something that's between the lines in what they've written. And I'll tell you a story about that in a minute. But so then by the time we'd settled on 300 or 400 people to meet, I had a sense of who I was meeting. And then you'd go around the country and you'd meet those people in 50s, groups of 50 or 60. And you got an opportunity to observe them, and you either confirmed your opinion or you came up with a new opinion about them or whatever. And then by the lunchtime, we were having to send people home. And then I'd spend the afternoon pulling people out of the crowd and just taking them aside and sitting down and talking to them and coming to a very personal conclusion about them. And it was in those interviews, which were extraordinary in a sense that I had some of the most bizarre and intense and emotional conversations in 10 minutes with people I've never met. Mm-hmm. Because you've got all their life before you there on the forms.
Mm-hmm.
And they confess all sorts of stuff, and I would make kind of intuitive leaps from things they'd say and suggest things to them. And it's a process that you don't, I don't know if there's any parallel for. You know, psychologists can't do that because they're constrained by ethics, and journalists can't because they're trying to get to a particular truth. But all I was trying to do was get to the core of who this person was and what their story was and what then motivated them. And, you know, you'd get very... A lot of people would cry. Not because I said mean things to them, but because you'd ask them questions that would make them go places where they'd suddenly become emotional. And when I had that closeness to them or found that core of them, you knew who they were, and that wasn't an act anymore, and that's who you are, I know who you are. And then you really had a sense of what they represented in terms of a dynamic, you know, in terms of what they bring in terms of story and what sort of characters they were like to be. Can I tell you a sidebar story?
Yes.
Absolutely.
I was mentioning something about the reading between the lines. There was, I'd never forget, Sarah Marie's form had a very long list of reasonably posh-looking Catholic schools that she'd gone to.
Okay. That's funny in itself.
And then it was her current occupation, which was the... I don't know quite how she described herself, but basically she ran a gentleman's club.
Mm-hmm.
Now, nothing else she said on her whole form was particularly interesting. You can imagine how Sarah Marie would answer questions.
Yeah.
And there was nothing particularly interesting in her tape. It was like, oh, hello, I'm Sarah Marie. Ha, 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 ha. It was nothing about it. But it was the fact that she'd gone to all these expensive Catholic schools and then was running a gentleman's club that intrigued me. And I thought, when better meet her? There's some story there. I wondered, how do you go from expensive Catholic schools to running gentlemen's club? Must be a story. And, of course, the rest is history. But it's not always obvious, I guess is what I'm saying. And that's why you can't, I don't think, delegate it. Because a straight researcher wouldn't be trained to see that or spot that or...
No, definitely not.
Or they wouldn't know how to bring it up with you and say, don't you think this is interesting?
Fair enough. Can we ask you what it's like to be the executive producer of Big Brother on a day-to-day basis?
Tiring.
Tiring? Were you living in Queensland permanently at that stage, or were you living up here 3 months and somewhere else for the rest of the year?
I lived in Sydney. Naively believed my employers when they said you'll be able to come back, you know, every couple of weekends and see your kids. it'll be fine. Of course, that didn't work out. I came back once in 3 years.
Really?
For one day. Well, I'm sorry, that sounds worse than it is. During production,
yeah.
I was up there all the time but for one day. So effectively, I'd do 4 months in Queensland. And I don't know, honestly know how I could have done it if I'd been at home. I had rented accommodation. I had somebody who cleaned. And they worked out that I wasn't eating, so they eventually started having somebody come in and put frozen meals in my freezer and do my grocery shopping, because in Queensland, the idea of opening late is 8 p.m. And opening early is about 9 a.m. Well, I was at work before the grocery stores opened, and I was at work when they closed. There were no restaurants that were open. And then they eventually started actually bringing me... they assigned a runner. I sound very helpless, like I need looking after, but I was just so completely focused on what I was doing. They assigned a runner to find me wherever I was at lunchtime, and find out what I needed for lunch and bring it to me, because otherwise I wouldn't eat and I'd just forget to eat until the end of the day. I was just so busy basically doing that 7 days a week. It started to wear on my health a bit. But the other thing is, every other member of the crew at some point during the week used to go and let off steam by going to the pub or going out to dinner and having a few glasses of wine or something. When you're Big Brother, you actually have to be sober, straight, 24 hours a day, because you never know when the phone call is going to come that says, this is happening, what do you want done?
Mm.
You can't be just had three glasses of wine or two scotches, you've got to actually be ready for it. And you often get woken up in the night, and if you could wake up, make a clear decision and go back to sleep, that was all right. But if you'd had a few glasses, I wouldn't like to be making the decision.
Mm-hmm. No, it sounds like an incredible commitment.
Or stupidity, I think, looking backwards. I used to go to this Big Brother convention. Endemol has one every year.
Oh, okay.
And they'd run it in Holland, and all the Big Brothers from around the world would come, and we'd all sit and talk about what we did and what worked and what didn't. And the guy from Germany came over to me and he said, "Oh, so you're the other one." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "There are only two people in the world who've done three." "You're one and I'm one. We must be mad." Ha ha ha. Off he went. He's a very charming man. Mm. But basically that's true. The Dutch told me when I started, the Dutch women that came out to be the police, the format police.
Yep.
I said, "Oh, Connie, I'm too old to do a show like this the way you're describing it." And she said, "No, you're about perfect." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, our international experience is anyone younger cracks under the pressure. Anyone older dies of exhaustion." So you're in a very thin band of survival where you won't crack under the pressure and you won't die of exhaustion.
That must have put you right at ease walking into
that completely. Oh, good then.
Can you tell us what Big Brother actually does in situations where there's a live show going on stage and Big Brother is interacting with the housemates, like nominations or evictions? What's your role in something like that?
Well, there's not that much live role in evictions, or there wasn't when I was there. Occasionally, you know, there'd be some announcement to make. But, yeah, you're right, in terms of nominations, there's quite a lot to do. So they ran quite differently. If an eviction show, you know, there'd be screenings of packages on the Saturday, there'd be screenings, final screenings Sunday morning, there'd be a rehearsal Sunday lunchtime, final scripting, sorting all that stuff out from Sunday afternoon. And then during the show, I'd effectively stand in the outside broadcast truck and act as a backstop for the actual show producer. And, you know, take the calls about the voting and all that sort of stuff and pass all that on and take the calls from the network. Whenever there's some call from the network telling you something they don't like or something they do like. And basically be there in case something terrible happens.
Yeah.
You really earn your money when something terrible happens, but the rest of the time it's kind of got its own momentum and it's running. In terms of the eviction show, the nomination show, because I was the voice and the executive producer, we'd review all the packages and the rundown and the script during the afternoon, and then I'd go to the voiceover booth and do the actual interrogations. And I had a separate communication switch to the truck, so if I wanted to tell the truck anything or they wanted to tell me, we could talk while I wasn't actually, while my mic wasn't live.
Mm-hmm.
That became supremely exciting on the night that Turkan decided to leave during that Intruders special. I don't know if you remember that.
Absolutely. Cut into Rove, I think, didn't we?
Yes, we took over the whole network. But it was the, you know, if you'd had a camera in the voiceover booth, it was, would have been fairly hilarious because I'd be talking to Turkan in my calmest voice. Yes. And as soon as she'd start talking, I'd be listening with one ear and then on the comms to someone else going, "Right, stop, get that other guy out of there." Yes, Turkan. It was like the Jekyll and Hyde thing, but you could be very rapid fire with all the people on comms and then very calm with Turkan. And it was an amazing night because it was, someone said when we came off air, "That was an amazing piece of television." I said, "Probably was. I only wish we'd thought of it." You can never, you know, that's the beauty of that format. The most fantastic things happen that you didn't plan for.
Yeah.
and all the things you plan for go pear-shaped, but all the things that are marvellous are just acts of its organic nature. And the fact you're dealing with real humans, it's beautiful in that way.
Okay, I've got one final question about being the executive producer.
Yeah.
Do you ever slip up in general conversations and start sentences with, "This is Big Brother"?
Oh, no.
Never done
I do that? Everything I can to avoid it. There was a period where every children's party at my house, someone would say, "Do the Big Brother voice for us, do the Big Brother voice for us." I'd go pick somebody up at school and there'd be people yelling across the playground. And I'd always respond, "I'm just Tim's father," or "I'm just Amelia's father," or whoever's friend it was.
Mm.
I really actively tried to be just me as soon as I left the building, you know. It's a job, it's a role, it's a thing, but I'm just a bloke, you know. We've all got jobs, we just do things. So I don't seek to perpetuate that.
The first Big Brother series, you chose Andy, a dominatrix, to enter the house. What was your reasoning behind that?
Well, now there's a story of accidental genius. Everyone thought it was a masterstroke, except it was complete accident. The reason Andy went in, Andy had told us in the interviews, and in fact had quite elaborately planned this, so that when we sent researchers out to meet her family and meet her friends and all that sort of stuff, they repeated the same story. But she was at that stage married to a young man, an Australian, and the story that she told, which is true, by the way, it's just only part of the truth, was that she was Brazilian. She'd studied psychology at Stanford University in San Francisco, and she had a degree, but it didn't work here. But because she was in love with this guy, she'd come here.
Okay.
Right. And so it was kind of an interesting story by this startlingly huge Brazilian woman who was very beautiful. You know, sort of giving up her career for love.
Yeah.
And she was startlingly beautiful. So the first hint that this may not have been quite the full story was when she was going into the house and the bags were being inspected. And the first year we didn't do a pre-check. We did it as per the Dutch protocol, where you check it live on camera, and you had the security guards there. And I had this quite nervous-sounding producer on the intercom saying, Big Brother, we need you down here now. We're at security." And I said, "Why?" They said, "Well, are there any rules against taking 7 dildos into the house?" I was like, "What am I getting myself into here? I've got no idea." I said, "I've really got no idea." They said, "Can you come down?" I said, "Yeah, I'll come down," because I was in the outside broadcast truck. And so I came down, and as I was walking there, or sort of sprinting there, I was thinking to myself, "Well, what would the rules be about that?" So then I was asking over the intercom as I was on the way, "Are they battery powered?" "No, they're not battery powered." "Okay." So by the time I got there, I said, "I don't think there's any rules against this." And I don't know why anyone would need 7 dildos. I suppose one for every day of the week. Okay, let her in. I went to back off to the OB truck. Got back in the truck pretty quickly, and then everything's working away nicely, and people are going in, and it's all fantastic. And she turns around and announced, I think, to Johnny, "I'm a dominatrix." And we all in the truck looked at each other and said, "You're a what?" And then there was a sort of silly grin, and we were like, "Well, it's happening. We'll just let it go and see what happens."
Would have been a bit late to replace her at that point, I would think.
Well, again, there's no rule against it, but it wasn't actually quite why we cast her. But then, of course, everyone thought it was a fantastic piece of tabloid rating spike, so,
Well, is that why the following year someone went in with their piercing kit? Who was that?
Oh, you've got a better memory than I have. That was Sarah, maybe. Yes.
Yes, it was.
It was Sarah. Again, it's a kind of bizarre request, but people turn up with all sorts of things, and you go, oh, well. There's no law against it.
Fair enough.
You know, I think that might have been a little... From memory, she had an idea that it would be a conversation starter.
Mm.
And you go, oh, well, I'd like to see you try and start a conversation if you'd like me to pierce you. But she got away with it. Who did she do?
Todd got his tongue pierced, or his nipple or something. The dreadlock dude.
Todd was in series one. Todd was in series one.
Yep.
I spoke to him today.
Well, he had a tongue ring or a nipple ring or something.
He had a piercing.
Yep.
And there was...
Of course we had
Gordon. Oh, look, I don't know. It's all a bit
Gordon
of a
was my favourite.
I remember it 7 years ago.
Yes, it's a long time.
It's a long time ago.
Mm.
You know, just saying, I was talking to Todd today, that's purely accidental. Some of them I speak to, you know, irregularly, but on an ongoing basis still, and others of them I don't really hear that much of.
Who are you still in touch with? Who's doing what around the globe? Give us the goss.
Oh, I don't know whether it's goss. I would never give you the goss.
Oh, come on.
Because that's part of my sacred priest-like role. I hear all sorts of stuff. I saw Blair when I was in London recently.
Mm-hmm.
He was there doing something on the West End. I still see Peter Timms around for various reasons. I heard from Chrissy from Series 3 today. I was talking to Reggie because she had a baby. You know, I don't mean to be excluded, you know, that's not an exhaustive list, but of people I've spoken to recently, that's probably it. For a while there, until Gordon went off to Iraq to be a bomb
Human
shield or whatever
yep.
it was, yeah, I stayed in touch with him. I haven't seen him since he got back. I went to Marty and Jess's wedding.
Yes. I think we all remember seeing you on the TV there.
Did you? I don't think I was on the TV.
Oh.
I think Which I am.
Were you hiding behind Gretel?
I was hiding beside Gretel. I think, as far as I remember, I was quite specific about I don't wish to be seen.
Yeah. Do you still speak to Gretel?
Oh, sure. I had lunch with her before she started the series. And
yeah, obviously she'd be busy now, but...
Yeah, we don't see each other during the year during the season all that much, but, you know, Gretel... No, I mean, it's easier, actually, now that we're not working together. It's easier, in a sense. It's a hothouse behind the scenes as well as it is in front of the scenes and in front of the cameras. And I've got an intrinsic friendship and affection for Gretel. But there's a part of both our jobs that means that's sort of got to be held at a certain distance while you're doing the show.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's much easier. You can just... catch up and go, hi, how are you, and talk about life and things that matter and not have to worry about what the current issues on the show are.
Yeah.
And does she think you're crazy for leaving, or do you think she's crazy for still being there?
Do you still beat your wife? I think that question qualifies as. I don't think either. I think it's a very different proposition. Her job... as intense as it is, and how, you know, it's quite concentrated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no way I could go out and do a live show. Right?
No.
Yeah. Although it was one night I considered doing it, but in desperation.
I think there's a story there.
Yeah, there is, but I'm not going to make it to air. But there was a problem, and I thought the only thing I can do right now is to walk out on stage and say, "Hello, you don't know me," but. But more broadly, you know, she's got that intense preparation and walk on the show. She does, and she gets morning off the next morning, and then she's on for the NOM show, and then she's off, you know, most weeks. Whereas the EP job is kind of a 7-day-a-week, 24-hour thing. And I think the show would be she's the public face of it.
Yep.
And the show would change really radically if she was not there. I don't know how many people appreciate how pivotal her capacity on her feet is. You know, if you work with live talent, there's so few of them who could react with the aplomb she reacts when all hell breaks loose. Yes, she used to say, oh, they're all drunk up there or something, and Big Brother's drunk tonight or something disrespectful. But she could hold the audience whilst we were drunk, we probably had some big problem behind the scenes. And she could make a joke of it, keep talking, and deal with it. There was somebody's eviction that was terrifying behind the scenes. The voting server went down, and it was really close, and we couldn't get an answer as to who was to be evicted for like 11 minutes or something. And, you know, it was very desperate, and you just say to Gretel, Phil!
Bam! Juggle! Find something!
Yeah, talk about anything. I haven't got time to tell you what to talk about because we've got to sort this out. And she's just fantastic, you know. And, yeah, it's very high profile, and people give a stick about all sorts of things. But stop and think about, just pick someone out of the universe and say, oh, they could host it as well, and it's got a very short list, I promise you.
She does do a good job.
She does, absolutely. Big Brother 2, you decided to take 6 potential intruders and put them in their own little house away from the television world so they couldn't see what was going on in the house. How did you think that experiment went?
In retrospect, I would have spent more money on it. In other words, used the material from the house, from the outside house, more extensively.
Yep.
And it sounds like it's stupid on the show that costs that much, but that you haven't got enough money to do everything, but I promise you, you can spend all the money. I think, actually, it created a fair bit of the dynamic when those guys came in. I think it was quite different to 3 unknown people coming in. There was the Brody love affair with... Now, I'm hopeless at everybody's names, but he came in and was having a relationship with one girl from Adelaide who left 2 days later. So there was a whole lot of the dynamic between those intruders that actually was set up in that environment off camera, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, a lot of people like to poo-poo the divided house thing.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was very publicly derided about that only recently. But what that set up, actually, the drama continued to all last couple of weeks in terms of where all the allegiances in the house lay. Once people decide you're in my group, you're out of my group, it makes a big difference to how they play thereafter. And once the house was no longer divided, they still acted for weeks and weeks as if they were divided. And a lot of the drama and fights and the Chrissy Benn thing and all that stuff came out of all of that. Whilst they may not have an immediate explosive effect, I think those sorts of initiatives have an interesting impact on the longer-term drama.
While we're on Big Brother 3, can I ask you about the Belinda incident?
Where is this being transmitted?
On the internet?
I can tell you that for a period, about 6 weeks, I was living under the delightful news that I would be the one who went to jail for the fact that went out on the internet.
That's scary stuff.
Because I was a nominated publisher in Queensland.
Okay, let's leave that one.
It was happy. It was fine that it went out in New South Wales. It's just the fact that it went out in Queensland.
Yeah. Of course you can't control
it. I'm very sensitive about that. I've got no desire to go to jail.
Okay.
So, with the house split in two, there were two very obvious groups, very younger group in the square house and a more mature group in the Circle House. Was that...
God, your memory's amazing.
Well, you've got I've been planning. It's all right, I've been planning. Was this to see what the public rathered, or was it just pure coincidence?
It wasn't pure coincidence, but it was more about creating two groups who'd actually have a contrast between them and who would bond naturally. In the sense that one of the issues in a house, in a Big Brother house, is trying to make sure there's somebody for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, it kind of bodes or it pushes you away from too great a diversity, generally. Because if you put in one 45-year-old person, they're not going to bond with anyone and they'll get evicted immediately. It's much more interesting to have groups of people who are trying to get on and who have some enough common ground that they can. So the thinking behind that division was that group of people will be interesting in their own right and will try and get on.
Mm-hmm.
And that group of people will be interesting all right. And those two groups will be different.
Okay. Day 23 saw the walls come down. How hard was that to undertake while the housemates were actually still inside the compound, basically?
Technically fairly fabulous. Had cranes and... Did you see all that footage?
Yeah.
But other than that, you know, it was a great piece of work by the art department. And
that wall was actually built over the pool, if I remember correctly.
Yes, very cunning piece of thing.
Pool.
They actually took that two-house idea, and various other countries did it, and they were left. They let it run a little bit longer. Got quite interesting results out of it in South Africa, particularly, I think.
Okay.
But I don't think anyone put it over the pool. I think that was a Michael Richards special.
There you go.
You decided to remove the visibility of the cameras in Big Brother 3 as well. Any particular reason for that?
Do you remember in Big Brother 2? I don't know how much of this actually went to air. It would have gone to air on the internet. Big Brother 2, I think, we had the big rebellion where everyone thought they knew more about Big Brother. All the housemates thought they knew more about how Big Brother worked than we did.
Mm-hmm.
And one Friday night, I got the shit from all and I said, right, there's to be no communication. And all the hothead operators had to do nothing. I don't want any of the cameras moving. Just give the appearance we've all disappeared.
Yeah.
I actually remember this. It wasn't one of the daily shows.
Was it?
Yeah.
And it totally, totally freaked them out. And they suddenly stopped, you know, being smarty pants. And they all basically went to bed and got depressed. They didn't know what to do. And I went, oh, shit, that's a bit extreme. And so, you know, I called them all in and I said, right, okay, is everyone over trying to predict what's happening here? Can we just, you know, I like to make a wildlife film. I just want you all to play, do what you like, and just don't think about the cameras. And anyway, cut a long story short, it kind of informed my thinking about 3.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking, well, if they never had that, if they never had the sense that they knew what we were looking at and what they didn't look at, what we weren't looking at, it would give us a more naturalistic performance at a time when it's getting harder and harder to get a naturalistic performance because they all know more. They all, you know, there's never that innocence that you got in Series 1 where no one had a clue what was going on.
Fair enough. It was cute, though, in the earlier years to see them spitting water at the camera outside trying to get the windscreen wiper going.
Ah, yeah, that was cute. But you see, then you get copycat behaviour happening. I think somebody came in the Series 2 and tried to get it, you know, wanted to get the same scene. You know, there's a sense after that, you know, it's like, I want to do the scene that so-and-so did. Well, hang on, it's not a scripted thing. They did that spontaneously. And, you know, knocking that out of people is hard. Can you just be yourself and come up with your own ideas?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. It was also the start of Up Late that year. When it first started, there was no host, and then Mike Goldman showed up a little while later. I don't think there was any quiz show type events during that series, although I could be wrong. Was it Network 10's idea?
You are wrong.
Am I?
There was a bit of a clue that he used to ask questions. The real genesis of it was the fact that I saw this thing in Germany where they had a woman lying on a couch doing a late night show, crossing to the house.
Okay.
And I thought, that's fantastic. And the other thing is that it's really a 24-hour event, and there's a piece of dogma in the Endemol world which I believe in, which is more is more. And so everywhere that they put a 24-hour cable channel in running from the house, the ratings went up on the free-to-air television.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody actually watches all 24 hours, but they turn it on and it sort of piques their interest in a scene, and then they go to the condensed version on the free-to-air. So I had the view that we should be taking over as much of Channel 10 as we could, because we couldn't do a pay channel. There was politics between Foxtel and free-to-air at that point. And let's do a late-night show. And then I have to say I had absolutely nothing to do with the iteration of it. It all happened independently, thank God.
Okay.
Another production team was sent up to do it just because we were stretched to the limit. You know, the rest is history, as they say.
Mm-hmm. Well, looking back across the three series, what would you say were the greatest moments and the greatest housemates that were in there?
Oh, well, Big Brother loves all his children. Gee, there's a lot, and then there's none. I think the most powerful moments, which probably therefore equate to the biggest moments, I'll never forget Johnny's farewell, Johnny's eviction.
Mm-hmm.
And let me say one more time for the record, Johnny's a fantastic bloke. We did everything we could to turn the press down, and you can't turn the press down.
Mm-hmm.
It was just the most amazing scene, the way that him going and Blair in the light shone by the garden flood lamp. Blair had two tears running down his cheeks, yelling over the wall to Johnny.
Mm.
And I remember thinking, if I'd had an art director in 5 days, I couldn't have made that scene more beautiful.
Yeah.
I think Sarah Marie's moment coming onto the stage will always be in my head. I remember seeing her before she went onto the stage, and I said, you know, just take a deep breath. You're not going to believe what's going to happen here.
Yeah.
And she just didn't get it, and in that classic, wonderful Sarah Marie, where, oh, okay. And she walked on the stage. So I thought, I've really got to prepare her for this. And she walked on stage, and her jaw hit her knees, and it's just the most innocent moment, you know, it's just complete. You can see absolutely everything that's going on in her mind. It's beautiful. I think, and Tim Klukas deserves credit for this scene, I think the scene where Peter's brother ran into the house at the end of Series 2, that was Tim Klukas' idea, was an absolutely beautiful scene. Turcan leaving, not leaving, was a great night. Chrissy taking on Ben.
Yep.
And calling him whatever she did, a coward. And by the way, I'm very fond of Ben. I think he's a very intriguing man. That's about what comes to my mind off the top of my head.
So after 3 years, you obviously left. Just had enough?
Mm. Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough.
Absolutely. I really only survived the third one by telling I kind of committed mental suicide about 6 weeks in. I remember Tim Klukas saying to me, you look happier today. You know, Tim's the network EP.
Mm-hmm.
I said, yes, because I said, you know the story of people who say that they saw someone the day before they committed suicide and they haven't ever seen them look happier. I'm the same. I've decided this is not my future. I'm going to finish this show and I'm not going to do another one. And I can deal with it on that basis and I'll be happy for the rest of the series.
Well, I think it worked well. So there's some great moments in Big Brother 3.
Mm.
Reggie was amazing.
She's just an amazing woman. You know she applied the year before, don't you?
No, I didn't actually know that.
No, it's funny. So she was one of the big disappointments of Series 2 casting for me. I'd seen the tape and I went, oh, this woman's amazing. And she was absolutely nondescript. We flew her up from Tasmania to Melbourne.
Yeah.
And she was absolutely nondescript.
Mm-hmm.
I was the most disappointed man on earth when I sent her home. You know, anyway, the next year she applied again and I thought, oh, she was so disappointing last year. Oh, but she's still so marvellous. Okay, fire up. Flew her up. And she was a different person. And I said, I just have to ask you, you're very different to you were last year. And she went, yeah. Yeah. I had a terrible migraine and I was vomiting every 10 minutes. Every time and I said, did you tell anyone? No. I said, I really wish you had because, you know, I was really looking forward to meeting you last year and you hardly spoke and you... And if you just told me you were sick, we might have cast you last year. And you know, that's sort of complete... I never thought about that. I never thought of telling anyone that I wasn't myself. So we cast us at year three with much happiness.
Mm.
Fantastic.
Vincent, I think, also came very, very close to Big Brother 2 as well.
Not that I remember. Oh, you might be right.
I just remember seeing him on a clip package...
Yeah, there were a few repeat performers. I mean, there were a lot of people who came multiple times, but there were very few who got through on their second round in the way that they didn't on the first.
Mm-hmm.
There was a girl in Adelaide who probably should remain nameless, because the first year I said, I think you're not nearly as interesting as you describe yourself. And she said, oh, I am. And I said, I don't think so. I think you're just some kind of Adelaide princess. And friends say you're crazy, but I don't think you really are. And she came back the next year and confessed to, oh, look, I didn't want to tell you last year, but I'm bisexual and blah, 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 and that's why I was just not presenting as fascinating as the first year. Anyway, I was right. I think that was a concoction the second year, but I thought it was interesting that she... I actually thought it was a concoction at the time she told me, but I thought it was interesting that she came up with a concoction, and that in itself spoke of an ambition and a kind of guile that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Very few of them, I think, got through on the second time if they didn't get through on the first time.
So, Big Brother 4, obviously you weren't involved. Did they consult you at all?
Oh, a little bit. Not much. Just Chris Noble would call from time to time, just sort of... not, you know, what should I do in creatively, but just how does this work? What's the precedent on that rule there? Did that in that series, why? What was your reasoning? All that sort of stuff.
How do you work the microwave in the coffee room? Questions like that.
Yeah, I forget. but since then, pretty much no. It's all. I'm still good friends with a number of people on the show, but I'm quite studious about not talking about it to them. You know, it's a kind of ethical thing. It's just hard to imagine amongst television producers, but there really is an ethical basis for all of it.
Simple yes or no question. Do you watch the show now?
Very rarely, I think, is the truthful answer. My kids still do.
And finally, if the opportunity would ever arise, would you ever consider doing it again?
If it wasn't in contravention of my current contract, just in this hypothetical world, is that what you're saying? And if the production company would have me back and other little details like that. I don't know. I think it's like an old girlfriend. I really don't know that you can recapture the past, and I don't think you can do it in a fresh way. I think... it's never going to be as good for them, for the audience, for me. You know, it's like that was the experience then and should just be remembered probably how it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Maybe for a vast sum of money.
What about if they wanted you to take it to another country? Say they wanted to start Big Brother New Zealand or something, and you had that fresh start there.
I was very interested. I can say this. I was extremely interested when they were setting one up in the United Arab Emirates, and they were doing a Muslim Big Brother.
Okay.
And I actually asked, could I have leave without pay to go and do it, simply because I thought it would be so fascinating to do it in such a completely different culture, to do it in a Muslim world where they had to separate men and women and they had to have prayer time and all that. And they were recruiting people from all over the planet who'd done it, to go over and help with that. And I thought that was absolutely fascinating. But I wasn't allowed to go because the timing didn't work. And then the show was shut down, I think, in about 3 days because it was so controversial. Yeah. And but so it's a good thing I didn't go. But that I thought was very interesting.
Right,
it's a great format, you know that.
Oh, of course.
It is. It really is a great show. It really has been an absolute pleasure speaking with you tonight, Peter. I know I speak on behalf of a lot of Behind Big Brother Forum members when I say that we tremendously appreciate your work on the show, and we thank you for sharing some of the memories with us here tonight. All the best for the future, and we look forward to perhaps one day soon watching another show you produce. Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, great, guys. Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.